And tonight I'm incredibly honored to actually introduce to you a fellow that I have watched for many years now. But I realized as I was preparing my presentation tonight that I didn't have as much a clue about as I thought. I've watched him for about the last 15 years working with him, but I didn't realize his whole life. Grand Chief Ed John has been an incredible advocate and a hard worker and has dedicated his entire life and all his work to the change for Indigenous people across Canada, through BC and across Canada. And I had no idea the kind of things that he had been involved with, and so I'm really excited to share that with you tonight, and also to look at my friend and to acknowledge this great work, and I'm glad that I get to share him with you because I think he is a top speaker. The first thing I will share is that Grand Chief John's real name is Akayel Cho. This name is a hereditary chief's name that comes from way before the time of the European colonization. This is probably thousands of years old and comes down long lines that he should receive this name, and probably a great reason he is who he is today. Grand Chief Ed John is a prominent First Nations political leader in Canada. Chief John is from the Carrier village of Taché, 16 kilometers from Fort St. James, BC. Grand Chief Ed John earned his law degree from UBC in 1979. He had a solo practice for 12 years. During this time, he served as elected councillor of Tsuut'ina Nation for 16 years and also as an elected chief. Grand Chief became chief of the Carrier Sicani Tribal Council and later would become their chief treaty negotiator. For his service, he was awarded the title Grand Chief of Tsuut'ina Nation. Chief John is a fluent speaker of Carrier and was the founding president of the Yinka Dene Language Institute. He also played a prominent role in the creation of the University of Northern British Columbia. In 2004, he was awarded an honorary doctorate of law degree from the University of Northern British Columbia. Chief John was the First Nations representative, in the First Nations Ministers' Conference on Aboriginal Constitutional Rights from 1983 to 1987. In 1991, he helped create the First Nations Summit, the organization representing the BC First Nations involved in the treaty negotiations in Canada and British Columbia. He has served on the Summit Task Force since 1993, continuously being elected. In 2000, Chief John was appointed as the Provincial Cabinet Minister of Children and Families until the change of government. Chief John also plays a prominent role in the nation level at the Assembly of First Nations. In October 2006, he represented the Assembly of First Nations at the Second Indigenous Peoples Summit of the Americas in Buenos Aires. In January 2011, he began a three-year term as the North American representative to the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Peoples, of which in May 2012, he would become the chair. In 2012, Grand Chief John received a National Aboriginal Achievement Award in the area of politics and an honorary degree of laws from the University of Victoria. This is just a few that I should mention amongst many things that our Grand Chief has done, and I'm very excited to welcome him tonight. Grand Chief.
To my dear friends, for the welcome here tonight, thank you. To the Coast Salish people, Neltene, Ne Massi, No Tasni, Jane Keo, Lanauzo, Stilin Dine Yan. Dine at any way at it duck and it tatka, it was who need zeo ze latun tan. Satan, ne was then. Tunze and it any halga ni sa dahne da wa njan otas no tosas sin. Salta kell ni lot ne njadil ti bryd. Salta na da kell gna ia halltag. Da wa su masi no tas ni. I wanted to share some words with you in my language, the ideas that I learned as a child speaking, growing up in my community with my parents, my siblings, my grandparents, the elders, whose only language was ours. And that English was the second language that many of them didn't understand or didn't speak. And I was fortunate in that period to be raised in a community so isolated. In many ways, the nearest town is 45 miles away. And I remember around this time of the year in December, we'd go to a residential school and we'd come home and we'd take us a good day to get home on a team of horses and walking that distance. So I wanted to give you a sense of who I am and where I come from. Part of the Dene speaking, Dakel, we say in our language. Part of the Dene speaking peoples who extend from the Chalcotin in the southern part of British Columbia all the way north into Alaska, into northern British Columbia, into northern part of Canada, Alberta, northern Alberta, northern Saskatchewan. And in fact, in southern southeast United States with the Navajo Apache, who are our linguistic cousins, we understand their language as well. We speak the same language in northern parts, California, southern parts of Oregon, many different tribes who speak our language as well. We found out through people from our communities who went down to pick fruit down in the Oregon area. Somebody is sitting in a bar and listening to people talking and say, hey, these guys must be from home. So he went and introduced himself, said, no, we're from here. So now we understand about our identity and about who we are and where we come from. As our elders remind us and we remind our children and grandchildren, always remember who you are and where you come from. It's a lot difficult nowadays because English is becoming such a dominant language. But nonetheless, we continue to try and we continue to express who we are, like my sister here, identifying herself and her community. From the bottom of my heart, the Coast Salish peoples, as I said in my language, the work and the lands that we share and how important it is to acknowledge the Coast Salish peoples and their place, and that this is their traditional territory. It's never been surrendered, it's never been ceded in any way whatsoever, and it still continues to be that land that belongs to these people. And we recognize and sort that out as between ourselves, because we know the challenges in front of us are always problematic. In the 1859, February 14th, Governor James Douglas issued a proclamation that said all lands and mines and minerals therein belong to the Crown in fee. A proclamation by a governor taken with a stroke of a pen, all the lands, Indigenous peoples in this province. Because the year before, this province became a colony. Later on in 1871, it would become a province. In 1846, of course, we look at history that 1846 was the date of the assertion of Crown sovereignty. The sovereignty of Indigenous peoples did not vanish at all. And the Supreme Court of Canada in the Haida decision said that treaties, and we've seen many across this country and many across the United States, serve to reconcile pre-existing Aboriginal sovereignty with assumed Crown sovereignty. So the debate and the discussion around consultation and consent is an important one. It depends where you start. If you start from the assumption and the presumption from the Crown perspective that they own all of the lands and the resources, lock, stock, and barrel, then their assumption is that the best we can expect is some degree of consultation. But if, as you come from the foundation that Indigenous peoples, Aboriginal peoples, are the first owners and continue to have that relationship to their land, then you look at the concept of consent. And the relationship between the Crown governments and Indigenous governments is one of relationship, agreement, and consent. It's not domination, subjugation. But what's happened, curiously, throughout the history of this country in the 2012, we saw the 250th anniversary of the Royal Proclamation of 1763, and it said in there that the Indian nations with whom are connected should not be molested or disturbed in the occupation of their lands. And based on that, there were agreements made with tribes in the US, tribes in Canada, Indigenous peoples, and those agreements, some of them were never written down, some of them are written, predate Confederation. And that foundation became the foundation of a relationship. And when Canada became a country in 1867, a division of powers, we see a division of powers between the central government, the federal government, with provincial governments, that lands and resources became within the jurisdiction of the provinces. Indians came federal jurisdiction. And you often wonder why it was the case, and there's a number of explanations, one of which, well, you could not trust the provincial governments. Secondly, that it was only the national government who could deal with the Indian nations and make treaties. And in 1876, the Indian Act was put into place, the first piece of legislation. There was other legislation prior to that. But in 1876, under Section 9124 of the Constitution Act of 1867, the federal government had the responsibility or the jurisdictional authority to deal with Indians and lands reserved for Indians. But what happened was that that head of power, that head of authority, was exercised in a way to subjugate Indian people. So from that very early on, that period, we saw that Indigenous peoples were denied the right to access lands, their own lands, denied to access enfranchised or the franchise, the ability to vote, the ability to hold lands. And in the 1880s, even the very foundation and the very roots of who we are as Indigenous peoples in the West Coast here, our potlatches were outlawed and our people ended up in jail. So that name, Mikhail Choh, that was read out, is part of the traditional system. And we were not allowed to gather or to talk or to meet to discuss these things. And in 1927, the governments went even further. They outlawed, they made it illegal for us to retain legal counsel, lawyers, to talk about land rights. And that existed until the mid-1950s. So there was a tremendous amount, I mean, you throw that in, you throw into the mix this whole notion of Indian residential schools. I was absolutely amazed and, you know, completely overjoyed to see the numbers of people who came out here in the fall when we had that reconciliation walk. Because we really didn't know that people in this province even cared or even understood this. But the stated policy of the Indian residential school system was a part of that whole denial. It was as stated in the policy articulated by federal government officials to kill the Indian in the child. What that meant was that you take the child away from the family, the community, disconnect from family, disconnect from culture, disconnect from language, and recast that child into something closer to European.